Welcome back. Thanks for coming back. And thanks for taking the time to fill in those forms. They're very important to us. And I'd like to welcome you all then to this post-show expert panel of Disordered Contained. And on the panel, we're very lucky to have Professor Hilary Marland from Warwick University and Associate Professor Catherine Cox. And they're the joint principal investigators of a history project into the history of prisoner health. It's a Wellcome Trust funded project, and it's looking at the history of prisoner health in Ireland and England in the 19th and 20th centuries. And their research has formed the basis of the play that you've just seen. And with us also here is Derek Nisbet. He is a co-artistic director of Talking Birds, which is the Coventry-based theater company who've put on this production. And also we're very lucky to have Fiona Ní Cineda, the acting director of the Irish Prison Reform Trust. So in a moment or two, I'm going to hand this over to the audience, to you, to ask any questions you might have of the panel. But I'll just begin with one or two remarks and questions just to start us off. So Disordered Contained is actually the third play in a trilogy of plays that begun in collaboration with Talking Birds. First started in 2013 with Hilary and Talking Birds when they staged a play on the private mental lunatic asylums. And then subsequently there was Malady of Migration with Catherine and Hilary and Talking Birds. And so this is the third in this trilogy. So if I could just ask, what was the impetus to look at prisons in terms of mental illness?
Shall I start?
Yes.
Yes, as Fikra said, we did two plays initially about mental hospitals, asylums, as they were known in the 18th and 19th century. And we started out looking at the private asylum trade. And we had a really wonderful collaboration. We used some of our research. We used some other academic writings to create the play. And then Catherine joined us on the second project, which was about migration, Irish migration to Lancashire and Irish confinement in the asylums of Lancashire. And again, this was based on our historical materials. And we sort of developed a really interesting way, I think, of working with Talking Birds, a really good collaboration. And Catherine and I started 2 years ago, 2.5 yeah. years ago, on a new project on prison medicine in the 19th and 20th century. And we sort of realised very quickly that prisons were also a place where enormous numbers of mentally ill people were confined in the 19th century onwards. And we came fascinated with the idea of turning our current research into the third piece of the trilogy, because it's very much a project about the containment of mental illness. So it was a very nice continuation, I think, of you know, a very successful collaboration, and working in a similar kind of way, using our source material to inform the script, and working very closely with Peter Kahn, who's not here tonight, unfortunately, but the director and script writer.
Okay, and Derek, for yourself, as kind of as working on kind of, I guess, particularly the sound design of this, what do you think theatre can add to history? That can it add any texture or the emotional sense, do you think, of these kind of experiences that are enacted?
Yeah, I guess. It's very much a two-way street, what history can bring to theatre and vice versa. And I suppose, say, from the sound perspective of sound design, part of the job was imagining what the past sounded like, because we don't have any recordings of that past. Creating that world and that space for the stories to unfold. I suppose one of the first ideas was this table. It was a design idea by Janet Vaughan, the set designer, and we knew from the material that we needed to represent a cell, but also there was the whole world around the prisoners, not just the prisoner in the cell, but the world of people involved in decisions about their lives. So, yeah, a table where these debates could be made and where the reports that it's based on could be laid out. That was one idea. And then a transformation, I guess, into a cell and, you know, giving a sense of the dimensions.
Yeah. Mm. Thank you very much. So I'll just open it up to the audience now. Just to say, I have a microphone here. It doesn't amplify. It's for the purposes of recording. And I'm going to give it over to Sinead there just now to pass around. So if you'd like to ask a question, just raise your hand and we'll bring the mic over to you.
just for the purposes of kicking things off, just in relation to the sound, I remember we were up in Wolverhampton and Derek said he'd found the perfect sound in a car park, a kind of hollowness, and you know, the sort of landscape of sounds that we have at one stage. And last night there was a prisoner in the audience and he said how authentic it was and that it really sort of sent a chill down his spine listening to it. So yeah, a lot of thought went into everything, I think, really. Yeah. Over to someone else.
I suppose one of the other things we were talking about portraying was silence, which is, and of course, silence is never silence, so it's about creating a sense of what that might be, because, yeah, and also, because we're also in the bigger world outside. When we first did this show, it was in a shopfront theatre in Coventry, which is is an old shop converse, very different to this space, and this space brings a whole lot of different things, but also the sounds of the outside world going on.
And in fact, that was a real challenge, I think, of this production, wasn't it? I mean, when we started working with Derek and the rest of the team, we thought, how are they possibly going to do this? You know, how can we create a play which is about silence and separation of the prisoner? And, you know, you were the best judges of this, but I think Peter and the rest of the team did quite an amazing job of pulling out the sounds, but also, of course, the voices of the prisoners and the officers did emerge in this silent place, which in the end wasn't that silent after all. It was full of odd shrieks at night and the unravelling of the mental illness of the prisoners. But it did seem to be a particular
Absolutely.
Challenge.
Yeah. I mean, it was for us, I mean, when you read the material closely, you start imagining it yourself. But I think that's sort of, you know, sometimes we sort of talk to each other and say, oh my gosh, are we just imagining all of this? You know what I mean? Is that just our shared interpretation of the script? Do we talk to each other maybe sometimes too much? So it was really interesting to see Peter's take on that material. And there are a lot of similarities, I think, to our interpretation, but there are also differences, which is interesting to see other people's views and reading of the material, yeah.
Hi, Cormac O'Brien from UCD here. I think the comment on silence, I mean, silence is really about what's not being said, isn't it, a lot of the time, just to add to that. I'm really interested in the creative process, the devising process. You know, what was the starting point in the first rehearsal? We saw three performers on stage. Were there only ever three involved, or was there a bigger cohort of performers in those rehearsal rooms that contributed kind of in the knowledge that there would only be three on stage? You know, what was the creative process for getting the historical research to what we saw tonight?
For this third part of the trilogy, there was always three. It was always going to be a three-hander, but previous parts there's been a bigger cast, but we decided for this one we would use three performers to represent all these different characters. And obviously there was a decision about casting three women to portray a story which is predominantly about men, but also is a story about the women that are absent, or which you hear about in one of the songs. The process. Peter Can got a lot of research material
from us,
and digested that. And Janet, myself, and lighting designer Kath, all kind of brought our own things to the table, and Janet literally brought the table. And actually, that was the first thing, even before the script, so that came first. And then Peter's assimilation of the script, and then it's very much a collaborative process with Hilary and Catherine, back and forth. And I think that's what we really enjoy about it, and the fact that, you're involved in this and this editing and creating and getting things right, that feels important. And so when the performers arrived in the room, there was a script, and we worked from there. But the script very much changed over the 3 weeks, and with input and getting things right, the performers would be asking about what this particular character and particular key facts that came out, like that of the chaplain being paid twice as much as the doctor. That was a important fact in terms of the status here. So particular bits of research that really unlocked how the characters were going to be portrayed.
And I think a big thing about it as well is the idea that because we have this working relationship, or starting with Hilary, but then from the second one, it's a sort of it's a relationship of mutual trust, I guess, and mutual respect. So there are certain discussions about accuracy, but also you also have to let it go as a historian sometimes, and just sort of fine, it's not exactly as you think it, but there has to be space for artistic interpretations, for artistic license. But knowing that that's done in a very sort of respectful and thoughtful and reflective way. So I think it's wonderful to have that relationship and that collaboration with a group, and I think it'd be very hard to do it in any other group.
And sometimes they ask really hard questions. Peter at one point said, did the doctor and the chaplain spend time alone with the prisoner? And we were pretty convinced that they did. They did go to their cells and have individual cell visitations, but we had to go back to our sources and really fact check this as far as we can. But some things you really don't have a complete answer to, and that is where the artistic process, I think, becomes helpful. Really interesting. When we do have some insights from prison memoirs, etc., of what prisoners experienced in the cells, because subsequently when they left prison they wrote these memoirs up. But to us, we don't know an awful lot about the experiences of many, many prisoners. So I think their interpretation of Peter and the other team members was very important in that process.
Question over there.
Hi, I'm Alice Major from UCD. I'm just interested more about...
Can't hear you, sorry, Alice. Could you speak
I'm just interested in the sources that you used to develop the characters, in particular about the three prisoners. Could you tell us a little more about how they came into being?
The three prisoners. Well, I suppose they're a collection in many ways. As we said, we gave a lot of research to Peter, and then he sort of reduced it down, I guess, to as he worked through it, as he took on different experiences and broke it down into three characters. So, to some extent, each character is a composite, but also it reflects the information we know about specific prisoners. So you sort of have this, we can recognize sections from individual reports or from case studies. So the records are quite different to, say, asylum case records, where you have quite detailed, pages and pages of material. These are sort of more discrete collections, but together they sort of create a picture of individuals, I think. Yeah, I don't know if you want to add anything to.
No. Hi, just going back to your opening remarks about the history of that you were researching and looking at the containment of mental illness within prisons. And I suppose I have a kind of a trajectory which places more the creation of mental illness within the silent separate system rather than the containment, because in my head, I suppose, I see the that more modern experiences for an increase in mental illness within the prison system as mental health structures have changed. And could you reflect a piece on that?
Maybe Fiona might actually.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that is a great concern to us. I suppose you've three groups in prison, just to simplify it. You've the group who have serious mental health issues on committal to prison, then you have a group who have latent mental health issues and prison conditions exacerbate those and bring it out, and then you have those that develop mental health issues because of the circumstances they're held in. I was really struck in this production about what has changed. We have come a long way, but also what is a little bit the same. I have to give a big shout out to the prison chaplains today, because they are the hidden angels of the prison system. They're respected by staff and by prisoners and by everybody in the system alike, and they have huge compassion, and also with families, so that has changed. I noticed the shocking moment of self-harm in the corner. I mean, we don't have the stats or the information about incidents of self-harm in relation to people who are held in 22-hour lockup in Ireland, but certainly abroad we know that to be the case, and that specific shocking incident in the corner has been related. I was struck at the end when they were talking about 12 months, as if that's a long time. In Ireland, we understand that there's an individual that's been held up to three years now in it's solitary confinement if it's more than 22 hours a day in isolation. And we would also, and there's a move now to recognise that even if you're unlocked from your cell and you're allowed to walk around a yard on your own, you're still in isolation, you're not in your cell. And it's now getting closer to what meaningful human contact means, because we are all social animals. And we all know that there are hermits who coped and who achieved what was the aspiration reflected in this place. It worked for Leonard Cohen, you know, it worked for monks and arguably Luke Skywalker and Skellig Michael, you know. But the reality is, for the rest of us, we are human beings who need social contact. I mean, I was struck in the show, we're sitting in the round, but not in the panopticon, because it would have had to be that each of us could not see each other when we were sitting in the audience. And that was a stark difference for me. Regarding the prevalence of mental health issues in the Irish prison system, so we continue to put the poor and people with people from poverty, homeless, addictions, dual diagnosis with mental health issues, these are still the populations making up our prison system. I think in Ireland now, we perhaps as a society have we've moved a long way in how we respond to people with mental health issues, but we've still a long way to go regarding poverty, in my view. And the prevalence in the prison system, so for males, it's estimated at between 21% and 40%, and for women, it's higher, it's between 40% and 60%. The prevalence of psychosis in the remand, in Clover Hill remand, which is pre-trial settings, is I can't quote the facts, but the stats are about 7%, and this is multiples of the prevalence in the community. So we are still doing that. We also know that there are at any time 20 to 30 prisoners assessed as a need of transfer to the Central Mental Hospital are in Clover Hill Prison. It's a huge concern. It's a concern for the prisoners themselves, for their fellow prisoners, for the prison staff who do a great job of treating people who, you know, they should not be in those circumstances. So we are still doing it today. But one thing that we have achieved is that there is now an acceptance, and it's in law and human rights standards, that the deprivation of liberty is the punishment, and that prison conditions cannot be used for further punishment. And we have at least established that benchmark, but we certainly have a long way to go.
So your question?
I was struck by the silent aspect, but in fact, my perception had been that it would be the opposite. I noticed that when all three characters initially came to prison, I think that's what we had to believe, that they were relatively sane, and the shock of it put them into silence. But as they were deprived of, you know, contact with the outside world, they went from silence to speaking to themselves. You know, one lady was speaking to the hare and the other one was talking to herself, reciting stuff. But I didn't know, would the prison ever be truly silent unless cells were padded? Because as people struggled with mental health, I would have thought it would have been the opposite, that you wouldn't, the cacophony of screaming inmates would have been the furthest thing removed from silence.
I think that's one of the
sort of ironies of it. Obviously, we're talking about the 1850s here, so I just want to say that's what I'm commenting on. But that's exactly one of the issues, and I think that's what's picked up so well, is the idea that the sound of people suffering within these cells would have broken that ideal of trying to this enforced absolute silence, with the warders going around on their felts sort of slippers over their shoes so they could sort of listen into doors, and they themselves weren't expected to break the silence as well. So the warders, there was a degree of silence imposed on them. So yeah, I think you're right, there would have been these constant at night, and in some of the memoirs at night you would have heard in the memoirs people recount how they heard voices and people suffering, their fellow sort of convicts suffering as well. So yeah, the ideal of silence and then actually what it was like would be quite different.
And there was also, the prisoners developed all these techniques, yeah. As was also referred to in the script, of communicating with each other, using forms of ventriloquism. So when they were taking exercises, the warders would hear there was conversation, but they wouldn't be able to detect where it was coming from, and they did tap on the ventilation system and the pipes. So there were all these, and in the choir, in the chapel, when they were singing, some of the prisoners would be chatting away to each other, trying to have some form of communication with their fellow prisoners.
And they would sort of graffiti the stalls and the chapels as well. So it's sort of, when the separate system was introduced to Ireland, to Mountjoy Prison, Hitchens, who was the inspector of prisons, he visited Pentonville to get the model brought over. But when he looked at the chapel, what he commented on was the amount of graffiti sort of in the stalls that people have left their marks. And some of the records in the National Archives of Ireland, you find the odd note, basically, that maybe has survived from a convict where they were trying to sneak each other notes. And obviously not successful because we have the notes, so they made these attempts in various ways to communicate.
Question there, at the back. Hi, I'm just interested in the female aspect of the prisoners and the female workers in the jail, like the matron. Did they have any impact on the female prisoners? Or did they in any way improve the situation for female prisoners in the separate system of confinement?
Well, women prisoners were also put in separate confinement, but oftentimes for shorter periods, sort of 4 months, was often deemed reasonable and the maximum that women would be able to manage. So women were kept in separate prisons, and certainly in the English context and in Ireland. Yeah. And they moved, there was Brixton at one point, and then Woking, and then Holloway from the early 20th century. So they were subjected to a similar system, but generally for much shorter periods. And there were all these interesting comments, actually, that women found it much harder to endure separate confinement. And there was this wonderful reference in Liverpool to, this deprivation of conversation was the worst thing you could do to a woman, because she couldn't sort of have a gossip and torture the other women. And it was sort of a breaking down of this, of the bad influences as well, because prisons for women were often ways for prostitutes to be recruited, for example. So I think these sort of reformation elements were quite important too in the women's prison. Women prisoners were deemed quite difficult to deal with as well.
They were regarded as particularly incorrigible, basically. And certainly, Liverpool Borough Jail, it's an unusual prison in many ways, but it has had a huge female population, and you have female prisoners in and out. I think you came across one case of a prisoner, and she was in for her 107th time, am I right?
Yeah. In a very short
period. In a very short period. So, the attitude towards female prisoners was different.
I suppose that's what I'm asking is, you have the schoolmaster and the chaplain,
yeah,
and the doctor, who are very male.
They are,
But the matron was, I suppose, a huge influence, yeah, on the female prisoners. I wonder, in any way, did she ease the situation for the female prisoners in that system, or is there any research that shows that she had any impact, really, on their experience while they were in that
I haven't, in reading certainly from the Mountjoy matrons, I didn't come across anything that would suggest she would ease it. Mm-hmm. But I think it's important to bear in mind how much the individual matters in these contexts. So you could have a male doctor in a male prison in one particular prison, and they would seem to be more on the prisoner's side, whatever that means. Go to a different prison, it's a different dynamic. So it's interesting how important the individual actors, not to, but are in each context. And you know, so there were the rules, but then it depended on the individual's responses often, both the prisoners and the actual staff member. I don't know.
Yeah, and the chaplains were sometimes okay.
We did come across some nice chaplains.
And it's interesting because some of the, we have at least two very good memoirs written by women prisoners, and they describe in great detail the predicament of women in prison. The fact they are often prostitutes, they have no other ways of supporting themselves, and that these women really need help and reformation. I mean, these would be well-to-do women who were speaking for prisoners who wouldn't be able to communicate their experiences. But they did see the plight of women as a particularly, women prisoners as a particularly difficult one. And in Ireland, of course, there was a serious attempt at reformation after women left prisons.
Absolutely, and there would be, you know, staged release, as it were, to various institutions, reformative institutions. So this idea you could stage the release. And often if a woman started or demonstrated early signs of mental illness, that's what they would do. They would sort of, to relieve them from the extreme of the system, the separate system, they would bring them into an institution to sort of step release them. And sometimes they'd end up back in the prison and sometimes they wouldn't. So, yeah.
Sorry, I'm not going to hog the microphone, but is there anything about, like, ladies' committees? Are they allowed to deal with women who are in that separate system of confinement? Are they allowed to visit them or to have, you know, communication with them?
Yeah, you see a system of visitors' committees generally emerging, and for women's prisons there were ladies' committees that would go in. And the idea was that the prisoners would communicate any concern they had, or, you know, if they felt they, you know, weren't given access to a medical officer when they needed one, or, you know, other things, that they would communicate this to the committee, and then the committee would investigate and deal with it. So there were those mechanisms. Not quite sure how frequently they were acted on, because we don't always have that information, but in theory there was that facility.
Okay, so we have time for a couple more questions. Is there anyone else have a question? There, it's back there.
In the play, we saw a discussion about books. How much of this discussion, whether or not to include, to make these books available to the prisoners, how much of this is historical and how much is it made up by the screenwriter?
Well, prisons did have libraries. And certainly, I mean, parts of the play, I think, draw on the Pentonville example, where they did have a very ferocious, overzealous chaplain who did withdraw reading from the library and tried to restrict what the prisoners read to the Bible and other moral works. Reading prison is quite interesting because the chaplain there was quite different, and he was almost obsessed with the idea of teaching prisoners literacy, and well, all prisons try to improve the three R's. I mean, education was an important element of this system. But in Reading Jail, the visiting committee and other prison officers were really complaining. You know, the prisoners sat around reading in their cells all day, and they might do a bit of labour for a bit of a break from reading. I mean, this seems to have been a really interesting experiment that went on also in the 1850s. But I imagine, again, there was quite a lot of variation between prisons. But the principle was that, the reformers, I think, genuinely were convinced this system would work. And one of the elements of this was education, and the other was learning a trade, so that when the prisoners were transported, they would have a better start in their new lives. So elements of it were more optimistic.
Yeah. And then, of course, in Ireland, there's that wonderful overlap you always get between religion and education. So while there were books being provided for education purposes, there was then that concern about conversionism or proselytism, that if the wrong type of religious text was made available, there would be accusations that, you know, Church of Ireland was trying to convert to, Church of Ireland chaplain was trying to convert Catholic prisoners and vice versa, and then Presbyterians as well. So it all got a bit messy in the Irish case. So, and then you see in one particular instance, a particular tract was withdrawn because the Roman Catholic chaplain felt that it would be offensive to the Church of Ireland prisoners. So you had all these tensions trying to manage the education and therefore the library, the content of the library.
But sorry, that was indicative of Ireland at the time.
Exactly.
Because there's the famous story of Letitia Bunbar yeah. and the Mayo, sorry.
That wasn't just peculiar to prisons, no. Because there was, in the early 1930s, I think it was Letitia Dunbar Harrison was appointed to Castlebar Library, and she was Church of Ireland educated, Trinity College, and there was absolute uproar. And it was nothing to do with prisons, it was to do with, you know, there was a kind of anti-Carnegie Trust coupled with fear that the wrong type of books would get in. So I think at that, in... There were certain times in Ireland, whether you were in prison or not, the amount of literature available to you was probably pretty much the same.
Well, and books remain a huge issue today, don't they? Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of...
And opening times of libraries and school closures due to staffing issues. So I think there is still that understanding that training and employment and education are the best routes away and towards rehabilitation, but also relationships with family. And that's a bit that was reflected here, but was also absent here. Our connections with family on the outside, and also in terms of looking from the family in, that they have people returning to them after a period away, and so the importance of maintaining these relationships during their time. So a lot of those issues remain.
Yeah.
Okay, time for one final question, the lady there.
Hi, good evening. I was just wondering, just touching on, I suppose, the differences between male stroke female confinement, and specifically with regard to the Irish situation. I was just wondering whether the statistics and the prevalence of mental health issues when it comes to those female prisoners in the DOCA centre, just with reference to the type of, I suppose, the infrastructure, the buildings, the fact that it seems a world away from the male equivalent, the Mountjoy institution. Compared to the DOCA Centre, it just seems worlds apart. There is, it seems a huge differential in terms of like the homeliness almost, or the type of accommodation. And I'm just wondering, has there been a knock-on effect in terms of, I suppose, mental health issues and the prevalence? And if so, could that be translated when it comes to, I suppose, building prisons in the future? Or is it simply a resource issue that couldn't be replicated on perhaps the scale necessary when it comes to the population at large?
Sure. I mean, it's an interesting question. So, and it would be interesting to know what history tells us as well. So, I mean, conditions are different in the DOCA Centre, but it's still a prison. It's still a terrible place to be. Mm-hmm. I mean, the biggest difference are perhaps the visiting area and the contact visits and the support of the connections between mothers and their children, and also communal dining, which I think we're all informed by what we see on TV and with this idea that prisoners come together and they eat their meals together in lockdown. That does not happen. Prisoners eat in all the closed prisons on their own in their cells. There are a few landings and independent living units, so that there are pockets of communal dining, but it's absolutely not the norm. But in terms of best, I mean, the women's prison population is so completely different, you can't assume that the better conditions therefore lead to better mental health outcomes. There have been difficulties, or reported now, these are not up to date, but certainly there was an absence of a prison psychologist reported in the visiting committee report, the most recent DOCA's visiting report. So. And addictions at the level of 85% of the population. But the offending patterns by women are different. The very nature of prison is a male construct, which the historians will be able to tell us more about. There's wide acceptance that prison is not necessary for the vast majority of offending by women in Ireland, the vast majority. But it is also the case that this cohort of women have such chaotic lives, dangerous lives, and that it's not in the best interest for anybody to be in a prison environment, that's for sure. But it is true that often it is the safest place or seen as a place of respite for this group of women. And I've said this so many times before, there's no more damning indictment on Irish society if prison is the place which is a place of shelter and respite for a group of women. Everybody acknowledges that community-based sanctions are better. Well, they're better for women, they're better for all prisoners, but we're talking about women here, are better for all less serious offences, because there is serious offenders and offenders who continue to present a serious risk to society, and perhaps prison is appropriate for them. So there's wide acknowledgement that community-based sanctions and perhaps residential centres, but certainly what's called a one-stop shop where they can access housing support, mental health treatment, different supports in one place. Because expecting people who live in chaotic lives to be able to keep different appointments and different services in different parts of the city, which are not all in one convenient Lewis line, you know, but for, there's acceptance of the joint probation service and Irish prison service support strategy from 2014 acknowledged this. Everyone agrees. But there's no change. The number of women, the number of men in prison, and the average population has been going down, but women remains high and went up in 2016. And I would argue that is not the prison service's fault. That's society's fault. It's about not investing in community-based services and by allowing this to happen. I don't know if that's a long-winded answer, but perhaps it was too simplistic.
A question, simply, I suppose, with just regard to having seen the performance tonight and I suppose the learnings of what we know now doesn't necessarily work, and I suppose just with the VSB Doak as being the most recent or one of the more recent buildings, that was simply just, could, I suppose, our learnings and going forward and what we can, I suppose, take kind of.
Absolutely, if they could, round table visits, communal dining, you know, if that could be replicated across, and also the size of prisons, smaller prisons work better, they're safer for everybody, single cell accommodation, there are so many good practices in the women's prison, it is true, that if it could be, and it can be replicated across the male prison estate as well, absolutely, we'd be in a better place.
Okay, I think it's almost coming to 10 o'clock, and we're trying to impose on your time. I'm sure some of you want to get the bus home, but thank you all so much for coming. We've really enjoyed, I think, having your audience feedback here. Please do fill in those forms. They're very important to us to get a feel for the production. Oh, sorry. I forgot myself. Okay, and if you just take... just a moment, I think, to thank our expert panel of Fiona, Hillary, Catherine, and Derek.